Wargaming Recon is proudly sponsored by 127games.com, home of the cheapest Access and Allies miniatures. Find them at 127games.com.
This podcast is brought to you by Noble Knight Games, where satisfaction is guaranteed. Since 1997, Noble Knight Games has been serving gamers' needs globally. They stock over 100,000 new and out-of-print board games, role-playing games, CCGs, minis, and war games. They have it all. Noble Knight Games always deliver what they promise. Speedy shipping coupled with excellent and friendly customer service make shopping here a no-brainer. You'll find discounted pricing on most imprint games and reasonable prices on out-of-print and rare items. With over 15 years in the business, they know how to package your order so it arrives safely anywhere in the world. Want to transform your old games into that new item you've had your eye on? Check out their trading and selling your games section. They provide the shipping labels, you box up your games, and that's it. Don't forget to sign up for their weekly email newsletter where you can discover new and rare finds. Visit them online at noblenight.com.
Welcome to War Gaming Recon. I'm your host, Aaron Boston. Wargaming Recon is the only member of the Troll in the Corner podcast network to discuss historical and New England gaming. This is episode 93, interviewing Jonathan. Today, we are turning the tables. He has graciously asked one of his listeners to pose some questions, hobby and his personal life, so we can all get to know the man behind Wargaming Recon. Welcome, Jonathan.
Thank you for having me on the show, Aaron. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm a first-time guest.
Technically, you are. You are a first-time guest on a show that, first off, congratulations, episode 93. Jonathan's turned the tables on himself, but also on me, because I didn't expect to do the intro 5 minutes ago. I came up with some questions that I wanted to ask him. He said, give it a shot. So kind of a change up.
We have someone else to blame for that. I was thinking about it because you and I had been talking a while. When the idea first came to me, I was like, oh, how about you interview me? Would that be fun? Would you like to do that? And you're like, yeah. And the idea for that actually kind of came from you by way of Henry Hyde, because when you had listened to Henry Hyde's first appearance, I guess at one point in it, he said that the next time he came on, he wanted to have me talk and not him. And so
right. You
liked that idea and you told me about it. And I was like, oh, I know who I want to ask to interview me. And then the whole intro thing, though, we have to blame Ben Gerber, who is owner of the Troll in the Corner podcast network, because he did something like this on a recent episode of Indie Talks, where he had another podcaster who's also an industry guest, Peter Blix Bryant, come on. And they went the whole nine yards. So like they pretended that Ben has nothing to do with Indie Talks, and that Blix just found him out of nowhere. And so Blix totally branded the show as his own, as if he was the original host for Indie Talks. And I was like, this is kind of cool. And then I'm thinking, I wonder if I can get Aaron to do the intro. So I totally put you on the spot with that.
That's okay. That's okay. It's fun. It's fun. Well, first, Jonathan, I wanted to just ask you some questions about wargaming, specifically your background in wargaming. I know you're a big fan of Star Wars, and I'm sure your childhood included Star Wars action figures. You probably had some experience, as I did myself growing up in the United States, with those generic green plastic army men. But unlike our wargaming friends in England, we didn't grow up with things like I can't even think of what the name of the brand is. The
Spencer Victrix? Smith. Oh yeah, Victrix.
Never heard of Spencer Smith before 6 months ago myself. But
yeah, Victrix is a big popular name in Airfix, and there's a few
Airfix.
Other ones.
Yeah, that's the one I was thinking of. I hear it all the time on British podcasting shows. Okay, so I should just read the question without interjecting anything. Okay, so how did you, Jonathan, specifically develop an interest in historical wargaming? especially with all those 10 millimeter tall figures that are nothing like the Star Wars action figures that I'm sure you grew up with.
Well, I could make up a grand story about how one day I woke up and I had a vision that I would be a historical war gamer, and I too could podcast about it and tell people, but that would be a lie. So instead, the truth is really boring. And unfortunately, they say you should go with what you know, and if what I know happens to be boring, then I gotta bore you, is really what it is. But you're right about the Star Wars. I'm not sure how many people who listen to Wargaming Recon listen to my other show, Geeks Explicitly, but I talk about Star Wars there a lot, like so much so that people probably think I have an unhealthy obsession with it, and that might be true. But growing up, I'm a kid of the 80s. I was born in 81. So I remember seeing Return of the Jedi in the theaters, and I remember having all those old Kenner action figures. I still have a bunch of them, actually. They're not new in box, and they lost a lot of their guns and accessories, which means they're not worth as much. But they were well-loved and played with often. And you're right, those army men were awesome, because one of the cool things about plastic army men, and even now, is you can go to like a dollar store, or in Japan it would be like a 100 yen store, I think, and you can find plastic army men for like next to nothing. And growing up, my family, we had really no money. We were incredibly poor. So being able to have just about anything that wasn't a necessity, like people did what they could, but you couldn't go out and I couldn't, there would be no way I could ever have afforded like Airfix figures or something, even if I knew what they were, which I didn't. But to get some generic green plastic army men, that was doable. And I had tons of them and fought in like the yard in the dirt, and they're going and crawling around and ambushing one another. So I guess maybe you could say at that point I had an interest in wargaming, even though I didn't realize what it was, because that's very H.G. Wells, Little Wars kind of wargaming in the loosest of sense. And even from a young age, I was always really interested in history. I remember my mom taking me to the local library, and we would go many times a week. And then one day I was really sad because I realized I read all of the history books in the children's room. And then I proceeded to go into the adult section and tackle them. And the thing you need to realize is at that point, I was under the age of 10. I was really precocious, and I was like, I need to read. And why don't they have more about the ancient Egyptians and the Romans? And what's going on over here with the Rev War? How come we don't have more about how we got rid of those evil British who were trying to put us down? And yay, Boston Massacre, and like all that crazy stuff you think when you're a kid. So maybe the story's more interesting than I thought, and maybe that really is when I developed the interest in all this without realizing it, because at the time I was just like, I like playing with toys, and these are cool. But I would say that really the more true and boring story is that I played miniature games for a long time. When I was in high school, actually, a kid in my class who I ended up befriending talked about something called Games Workshop. And I was like, what is this Games Workshop? So he pulled up some pictures on the school computer on the website. And I looked, and I was like, these are really cool. And I still didn't understand what they were, but I knew they were awesome looking and I needed to have them. And lo and behold, that led me to play Games Workshop games. And I used like graduation money from high school to buy Space Marines. And I played that stuff for ages and ages and ages. And one day I realized that I didn't like some stuff about this. Like, I didn't like how expensive it was. I didn't like that they were always raising the price, that you were kind of looked down upon by other gamers and people who would play the games if you weren't doing things officially, weren't doing things a certain way. Like, there was a right way and a wrong way. To me, gaming should be fun. It shouldn't be, you got to do it this way or else. It should be, let's see who's having a blast. And just like, let's hang out and have a good time. So in time, I realized, I was like, I'm not really interested in this kind of stuff, but I had tons of it. And I was like, I don't know what to do. So slowly, I started transferring over to what we would call collectible miniature games, where I would get into like Axis and Allies. I got the board game as a kid, and they might still have them out, actually. They have these pre-painted collectible minis for the Axis and Allies land game. I was like, this is really cool. So I had picked up some of those. I picked up the naval version War at Sea. And also when it first came out, I picked up Flames of War. And the reason why I picked up Flames of War is at the time, I was really heavily involved into some sci-fi gaming. Mongoose Publishing is known for role-playing games primarily. But they bought the rights to a movie that I love, Starship Troopers by Paul Verhoeven. People make fun of it, but one thing people don't realize is it's intended to be a joke. It's supposed to like make fun of society and get us to think, whereas the actual book by Heinlein is, it wants you to think, but it's not a joke. So I was so involved with that that I was actually part of what they called the Mongoose Infantry, which was their demo team. So I would go around and demo the game, and I got free product and stuff. And the people who were into the game were also into Flames of War. And at one point, the Starship Troopers game just kind of petered out and died off. So I was hanging out with all these guys who were like, Flames of War is awesome. And I was like, oh, look, they got tanks. I like tanks. I like that kind of stuff. And I like World War II and history. And so I started getting stuff for it. But it was pricey, not as pricey as Games Workshop, so I couldn't get as much. And I was in college at the time, which I'm sure anyone who is in college now or has been in college knows means you don't have any money. And it's hard
indeed
to play a game like Flames of War or Games Workshop when you have no money. So I collected stuff. I bought the rule book, and it laid around sitting like in my room for ages, and I didn't really do anything with it. And eventually I transitioned to some of the other stuff, and then I just kind of spread out and I would play some Flames of War, but none of my own stuff, because I never really had the time or the space or desire to do much with it, insofar as like the hobby side of modeling and assembly and painting, all that kind of stuff. So I would just kind of play stuff and I'd hang out and see things. And I still, despite the cost of it all, was entrenched in Warhammer 40K and Warhammer Fantasy, partly because I just have so much stuff that I didn't really need to buy stuff. But then one day I was doing an episode of Wargaming Recon, although at the time it wasn't called Wargaming Recon. And I had a now former co-host who knows much more about historical gaming than I do, much more about historical wargaming. And he was talking about something called black powder. And I was like, what is this black powder of which you speak? So we did like an episode or two about it, and we would email, and he explained that black powder was a historical wargaming rule set that people who worked for Games Workshop helped to create. And so, of course, he said some magical names to me of people from Games Workshop who I got to know through the books that they published and articles they would write. Like, I felt like I knew them anyway, and I respected what they were doing. And I was like, if they're doing something that's not Games Workshop, maybe it'll be cool. And then I almost didn't get into it though, because he talked about how with this particular rule set, he felt you really needed lots and lots of stuff. Like, I'm talking hundreds and thousands of models. And I'm thinking, okay, I don't have the money for this. I just got married. I can't be dealing with all this kind of stuff. So I decided there would be a way I could do it on the cheap. There had to be a way where I wouldn't need tons of stuff. And once I realized what that was, I made the decision I was going to get into black powder. And I credit the exact moment when I started to consider myself as a historical wargamer as the moment I decided to get into black powder, emailed Henry Hyde, who is the editor now of Miniature Wargames, and basically freaked out on him. And I was like, Henry, what do I do? I have the book, but it doesn't tell me what models I need to use. It doesn't tell me what paints. It doesn't tell me anything. And you got to keep in mind that I came from this, what I call GW metric, where everything's all inclusive. Like, whether you need a tape measure or a thing to carry your models or the models, everything is branded with Games Workshop on it. And historical wargaming, I had learned, was not like that. It was so without sort of guidelines and boundaries. I really freaked out. And Henry, to his credit, took it in stride and gave me some great advice. And because of his response to my email, I was set on a course for what I wanted to do with historical wargaming. And so I credit the moment that I became, in my mind, a historical wargamer to the moment I decided I wanted to play black powder, I was going to do it my way, and that Henry basically set me straight. So all roads converge, in my mind, to Henry Hyde of Miniature Wargames Magazine.
Yeah, and I do remember you and Henry discussing that, and you credit him with providing you a very patient, lengthy a letter explaining all your options. So, ironic, it was episode 84 of Wargaming Recon when you talked about wargaming on the cheap, and that's the first episode I listened to, and I really, really was struck by that, as I'm a big fan people that are looking to spread the hobby across a wider audience without causing people to feel like they have to invest thousands of dollars in tiny metal figures that need to be painstakingly and historically accurately painted.
I'm not one of those guys.
Well, very cool. Do you remember a particular moment when you saw miniatures tabletop war game for the first time, specifically a historical game? I mean, you had some background with seeing cool painted miniatures on a table, but do you remember a time when you saw a table laid out and it was a historical battle and there were those little cards next to units that had long-winded regimental names printed on them? And can you tell us about that first game that you, not necessarily the first historical game that you witnessed, but the first one that really caught your imagination?
When I look back on my life as a gamer and as a war gamer, I realize that for many, many, many years, I kind of tap danced around wargaming without realizing it. Partially because of my love of history and partially from being a gamer and everything, and partially because of my dad. My father's a retired naval chief. He served 23 years, I think, in the United States Navy, and he retired on the USS Constitution. During the height of the Cold War, he went like all over the place. He served on the carrier Enterprise, and anywhere there was a problem, he was there, like Beirut, Lebanon, you name it. He served on a ship. He was in Vietnam. And partly because of that, I think, I've always had a strong respect for the military and a desire to learn about the military and the historical conflicts in which they've served. And like, I've learned since then that my family history really is closely entwined with that of America. I've been able to definitively trace my family history back to the Civil War, where I had a great-great-whatever who fought for the Union, one who fought for the, I was going to say the Rebellion, I'm thinking Star Wars again, one who fought for the South. And that was common then, but I know like a great-great-uncle of mine traced it even further back, and supposedly some relative fought in the American Revolution. So without realizing it, I think like fate somehow tied me not only to America and American history, but to wargaming. Because like I had this strong interest as a kid in history. I would watch all sorts of historical movies like Battle of the Bulge, which is as ahistorical as you can get. It talks about Battle of the Bulge, and perhaps one of the few facts that they got right is that there was a Battle of the Bulge in World War II. But everything else was just so fake. But like watching that and other classic, what I called war movies at the time, was something that I did often. Like I really was enthralled by them, and I would watch them with my grandfather. So it was a way to spend time with him and to watch something interesting. And I was just really into it. And even then, like I would play with old G.I. Joe action figures, and I would make forts out of video cassette tapes, which people nowadays, as kids nowadays, would have no idea what that is. But like I'd create a fort and different like terrain. I was basically making my own scenarios and tabletops in a sense out of video cassette tapes and G.I. Joe figures. And I would play out things that would be happening in the movie and create like my own scenarios in my mind. Well, the good guys, what if they did this instead of that? And what if they took this left turn and went down here? And maybe the Nazis could actually have been over here and we'll do this. And what about... And just one thing after another. And so I think between all of that, I always had an interest, but just didn't know that I had an interest in all of it. And the reason why I talk about all this is because it's directly tied to the very first time I ever encountered a miniature in the sense of like a miniature toy soldier, so to speak. I was on vacation with my parents down in Newport. There's a naval war base down there that my dad used to be stationed at, and it's actually more well known for all the mansions, the summer homes of all the wealthy people from the Gilded Age of America. Would love going down, and we would take tours of them and just do other stuff and hang out on the Navy base and all sorts of stuff. And while down there, I once happened to wander into what turned out to be a game store, and they had really old Games Workshop models. And there's that word again, Games Workshop. They had old Games Workshop models, and they were playing with them on the table. They had just a regular table set up, nothing fancy, green felt, and they had these unpainted models there where they were moving them around. I think they even had some painted ones, but very basic. And they were moving them around the table and doing things. And I was like, this is really cool. I don't know what it is, but I should buy something because I think it's neat. I might like to get into it. I looked at the price, and being a kid, I couldn't afford whatever it was. It was probably not more than like $9 or $10 for whatever the group of models was. But I was like, I don't want to spend $9 or $10 on this. I want to spend it on video games and candy. So I didn't get it. And years went by. And from time to time, I would think about what this thing was and that it seemed cool and how I regretted not spending the $9 or $10 on it and instead filling myself with chocolate and playing video games. So of course, years later, it was really interesting when I befriended that kid in school and he was talking about this thing, Games Workshop. And I was like, what is Games Workshop? And then it all clicked together. And at that vacation, we happened to go to the Naval War College Museum, which I have a huge love of. It is the location inside of the, I don't want to say original, but one of the earlier Naval War Colleges where people who enlisted in the Navy, officers I think primarily, would learn how to wage war, where they would war game, two words, as opposed to what like you and I do, which is wargaming, one word. And I say there's a difference because of Donald Featherstone, who probably is a topic for another day. But Featherstone really worked to try to combine the difference and merge them. But the important bit about the Naval War College Museum is that they had scenarios set up that would have been played before from the Cold War, from World War II, where there were like tokens and different things that represented ships and planes and radar arcs and potential sightings of units and things where they could write down what the orders were and like really involved wargaming, and I fell in love with it. I didn't know what it was. It's just like, oh, they're learning how to be better at being in the military. But I loved it, and lo and behold, things would just kind of line up trip after trip. Like, took another trip once to, I think it was down in Rhode Island, and there's a special topiary garden down outside of Newport, I think, where all these beautiful pieces of shrubbery, and they've been doing this since, I want to say the 20s or even early, maybe the 1880s, 1870s, they formed them into shapes of different animals. Really intricate ones, beyond what you and I would see in just general topiary kind of gardens. But inside of the house were original tin toy soldiers. Like one-of-a-kind pieces that were made by hand. The kind of stuff that they've since unearthed in Stirling Castle. And I was like, this is really cool. So I could just kind of see that, starting with like being a kid and watching war movies and all that kind of stuff, and then progressing to seeing that Games Workshop game, which at the time I didn't know what it was, and then things just kind of stacked up. And the more I saw stuff and the more I was exposed to it, the more I was interested. But I knew from the first moment that although I didn't really understand what the stuff was, and although I didn't really know what it was and didn't know the names for it, I knew that it looked cool, that it interested me, and that in some way, shape, or form, I had to find a way to be involved with it. And of course, as years went by, like I had forgotten about that until I got re-exposed to it. But I just think it's interesting how like all those years had gone by. And what if as a kid, I got into it? And I mean, when I was younger, I played things like Axis and Allies and Stratego and Feudal, which is a great take on chess. And I played all this kind of stuff and different things. So in a way, maybe I was like a board war gamer, I guess, earlier on. But that's not a term that I would have been exposed to. And also, I think it's probably kind of important to note, wargaming, as you had mentioned, it's kind of something that originated with all those British guys. So being over here on the other side of the pond would make it difficult because, like I said, I was born in the 80s and a lot of this stuff was being done in the 60s and 70s. So by the time it would transition to America, would have been the 80s and I would have been way too young for it. And that's what it was. I was like on the outskirts because I would see something cool and just wouldn't know what it was because I was a kid. And so it wasn't until I got to be in my mid, or I guess even early 20s, but basically my mid to late 20s where I started to become more heavily involved with all this stuff. So that now at this point, like I'm new to wargaming. And yet for me, it's ironic that I have a podcast talking about wargaming that's coming up on the 100th episode.
Well, you're new to historical wargaming. We'll put it that way, because there's definitely a lot of similarities between and some people might disagree with me, but as far as I'm concerned, I think there's a lot of similarities between, you know, like the fantasy and the science fiction and the historical wargaming, especially when it comes to miniatures. And I think they've kind of developed side by side and influenced each other.
Well, I like to say that I've been miniature gaming for years, and I've been wargaming more recently. But I don't think I ever would have got really as into wargaming as I have without that foundation of miniatures gaming.
Well, I thought it was interesting when you said that one of the appeals about Black Powder for you was that some of the same guys that were involved with Games Workshop, that you already identified their names, recognized their names from your Games Workshop experiences. You said something along the lines of, and this was something cool, as if war games along the sci-fi line weren't as cool as 18th century regimental conflict on the battlefield.
Well, I think, yeah, because at that time I kind of had become disillusioned with Games Workshop, mostly because of their price hikes and the fact that I felt like they were, and maybe still are, I'm not as up to date on their games right now, but at least at the time, that they were always more interested in what was coming out next, hyping the next release, finding a way to make the rules quote-unquote better, to push a product that was better than anything before, so that way you would have to buy it. And then next month, there was something better than that that could beat that. And then the month after that, something that could beat that, and just forcing this consumerism on people. And I'm thinking, well, we only have so much money, we only have so much time, so much space. This is ridiculous. I'm not just going to keep buying stuff because you're going to keep pushing it out every month. But when you're stuck in that, you have no option. So if you're playing that kind of stuff, you need to buy new stuff at least from time to time, because the old stuff isn't supported. They might say it's illegal to use in their games, or they might stop writing rules for it, and then you're not able to use it. And to me, that's just like, that's ridiculous. Like, if you purchase something, you should be able to use it how you want, within reason, and you should be able to use it for as long as you want.
Well, along that line of thought, how much do you like the whole concept with historical wargaming, that you basically can pick a period, pick a conflict, and you can choose one of many different rule sets for that conflict? You could modify an existing rule set and adapt it to that conflict. And then not only can you pick a scale to wargame that conflict, that period, but you can also actually purchase figures from a variety of different manufacturers and actually use figures from different manufacturers for your game, or for your series of games for that period. How exciting is that for you now, after spending years in the trenches with Games Workshop games?
Well, I think if you're looking at it for someone to get into wargaming, it's dreadful. It's one of the worst things in the world, because it is too confusing. It's not streamlined. Like, when I made the jump into it, I felt that I was alone in an ocean and I would eventually drown, because I didn't know what direction was safe landfall. I didn't know where to find the information, how to find it. I didn't know what models to use. I didn't know anything. And if it wasn't for Henry Hyde, I probably would still be there. Although maybe I would have figured it out. I don't know. But once you're...
Well, now that you're kind of have found some land to climb up on, I know you've really gotten into Brevoir as a period specifically, and 10 millimeter as a scale. Are you able to kind of appreciate the variety, the options, the liberating freedom that you have for your historical wargaming now?
Well, now that I kind of survived the initial jump, and it's a huge difference. I was really surprised, because I thought, well, I'm a miniatures gamer. How different can it be? So I had all these years of miniatures gaming, and it was really hard for me. I honestly don't know how someone who's a kid, who's a teenager, who's a first-time wargamer makes the jump. And that's one of the things I really want to work on. I want to try to find a way to give some reassuring and reasonable advice for people to be like, yeah, it's scary. Yeah, it's a lot to take on, but let me make it better for you. Let me make it easier. Now that I've transitioned past at least some of that, I love that I can just pick whatever I like. Maybe I like the look of this stuff better than that stuff, or I can just alter whatever I want. One of the coolest things, and one of the reasons why I really latched onto Black Powder is, well, it's two reasons. One is that I can't call it a rule set. I refer to it as Guidelines for Gentlemanly Wargaming, because in the book itself, the game designers and writers say, okay, this is how we play our games when we get together. We think it's cool. We think it would work for other people. If you don't like what we have here, it doesn't work for you, it doesn't make sense, or you just decide for whatever reason you don't like it this particular day, change it. Make it different. Do whatever you want. And as someone who came from that whole GW metric, you couldn't do that. You were looked down upon. It felt like you would be ostracized if you try to disagree with what the people who wrote the rules put, because they wrote or didn't write what they wrote or didn't write for a reason. And who are you to say that it should be different? Because you're just someone who bought their rules and is playing it. And in wargaming, it's completely different. It's so liberating. And for someone to actually write that into a rule set that they wrote, for me, coming from the other side, was like Alice going through the looking glass. Like the kids going into the back of the wardrobe and coming into Narnia and going, oh my God, this is wonderful. But for wargamers, they take it for granted. We take it for granted. We think, we don't like this rule set. Let's change that. We'll change this. Let's make our own. And someone who's not used to that, it's like an alien world, but in a good way. And I still have a hard time kind of adapting to that. But at the same time, I love that I'm not wed to any particular company. I like, for example, that with the AWI stuff, that I can use any manufacturer I want. I could say, I'm done with Black Powder today. I'm going to go try another rule set. I'll take these models with me, and really the only changes you're going to have to make, if at all, is how they're based, which can be a huge pain. But if you're lucky enough to have a group of guys like I do that I game with, we don't care about that. We care about having fun. So we can play with unpainted stuff. We can play with tokens. We can play with paper. We can play with stuff based incorrectly, and it doesn't matter to us because we just want to hang out and have a good time. And if you're that lucky, I think it's wonderful. And I say, why the heck not? Why not try other rule sets? Why not try other manufacturers? This also is a way that I found that you can save some money. One of the guys I game with had been talking about Old Glory for a long time, and I was like, what is this Old Glory? Well, Old Glory makes smaller scale models for wargaming. And one of the great things about them is you get a lot more models, depending on what the scale is, and it's cheaper. It's a lot cheaper. I look at some people who complain about the cost of some of the wargaming models, and they're like, oh, it's a whole, I don't know, $1.50 for a guy, or it's $10 for a box of stuff. And I think, that's not a lot. That's cheap. Over playing sci-fi stuff, I pay $50 for 5 Games Workshop Terminators. What are you talking about? So it's relieving, but I like being able to compare all the different manufacturers of models in particular. And I like that the different magazines tend to do this. WS&S, War Games, Soldiers, and Strategy, I think does this expertly well, where they'll have, in the beginning, they'll have what the new models are coming out by a company. And then they compare them usually to similar scale models by other companies. So you can see where they fit, because every company has a different idea of what 10 mil is, what 28 mil is, what 15 mil is. And they measure it differently too. Some go from kneecap to eye. Some go from boot to the top of the hat. Some somewhere in between. So you never really know. And then some of them are stockier than others. Some just look like they've eaten really well and are extra muscular, and others look like they've been living in Antarctica for 40 years. So it really helps to get all of that together. And WS&S, when they have a theme, and they do a theme for every issue, but when they have a theme and they want to talk about the models, I like they had one issue where they were talking about the American Revolution. And so they laid out right on the page, one right next to another, all the mainstream manufacturers for what their models were. And I think they did either 15 or 28 mil. And it was right next to each other. So right in front of you in color, you could look and say, Company A, oh, they're this big. Company B is that big. And you could see that they're similar poses, and then pick what company really resonates with you more than the others. And 9 times out of 10, this stuff's preferences. Whether it's scale, whether it's the model company, whether it's the rule set, it's just what tickles your fancy. And some of it kind of relies on other stuff. Like, for me, I went down to 10 mil because my gaming buddy Court said it's cheaper, you can get more of it, and it doesn't take up as much space. So at that time, my wife and I, we were living in a small condo, and I was like, I don't have a whole lot of space to put all this kind of stuff. I can't do 28 mils, even though I bought some 28 mil Perry Brothers medals in the beginning for AWI, because I was like, these look awesome, and I love the Perrys because they sculpted all that stuff for Games Workshop. I keep on going back to Games Workshop, don't I? But I was like, I'll do 10 mil. And so I did it, and I haven't looked back. I should say that I don't have a whole lot of 10 mil painted, though. But I haven't looked back at buying 10 mil because it fits in a nice little bag, and it's easy to carry around.
And the buildings and terrain scaled for 10 millimeter size are certainly easier to store and carry around than for 28 mil.
That's true. Unfortunately, for 10 mil, at least for American Rev, I really have a hard time finding buildings for 10 mil. One of the guys, again, with Adrian, who I mentioned from time to time on the show, he bought some 10 mil bridges, and it turned out they were too small. Like, they were true 10 mil, but the Old Glory 10 mil models are a little bigger than 10 mil. So we've actually learned that we're better off with JR Miniatures 15 millimeter buildings because it looks better.
And there's certainly some good paper models out there, Jonathan, that I keep hinting at too. This is actually interesting that you're a big fan of the American Revolution. And I imagine a part of that is because of where you've grown up and where you live. One thing that struck me earlier when you were talking about going to the library as a boy and really getting into a lot of books about history, I think the expression you said was, "Yay, Boston Massacre." How much of your interest in that particular period in conflict is due to your upbringing, your environment, and what is it specifically beyond that that really intrigues you about late 18th century North American conflict?
So I should clarify that statement because it sounds really awful. You got to keep in mind, at the time that I had thought that, I was a kid. I was in elementary school, and for me it was, the British are bad because they don't want us to have our freedom, and freedom is good. So they're evil, and it's good that they were put in jail and brought up on trial because they killed us. And so this helps us to do good things, but how awful that they got off. And why would anyone defend them and help them get away with doing this awful, awful thing? Well, since then, of course, I've been able to read up more about it and learn more, and it's not that clear-cut. And actually, what happened historically is the right, I would say the morally right thing, that they were represented because no one wanted to represent these British soldiers. The fact that, in all honesty, they probably could have cared less what was going on with us. They were in the military either because they were going to go to jail if they didn't, or because they were too poor to be able to do anything else. And they took the king's shilling either on purpose or because they were duped into it. And next thing you know, they're an ocean away from their country, and they're stuck here with a bunch of people who speak the same language but want to do something differently. And they weren't really guilty of it. The colonists instigated them and hit them with rocks and stuff. They bludgeoned them. So I don't know about you, but I wouldn't just stand there while someone's throwing a pile of rocks at me. I'd be like, what the heck are you doing? But I think you're right. I think growing up here outside of Boston and being in where all this history happened, I think it really nurtured for me a strong desire to learn more about history and to learn more about the American Revolution in particular in that time period, the French and Indian War, and all that kind of stuff. Because everywhere you turn, you see something. And here in America, we think something is old if it's from like the 1700s or even the 1800s. And that's kind of laughable when you look anywhere else in the world and old is like 2000 BC. But for us, that's old. And old, if it's still here, means that it's good and has some sort of importance. And here in Massachusetts and in New England, there's a lot of that old stuff. And it's revered and honored. And, oh, look, there's this old church. There's this old cannon. There's this old whatever. And it's everywhere. Like, you trip over it because it's all over the place. Every town has something, a marker or whatever. I can't drive to work without seeing stuff. It's like, so-and-so was here, or such-and-such was there. And I grew up in a town that was one of those towns of George Washington slept here. And, of course, the town was really proud of that. And my town where I grew up has a connection to Abraham Lincoln and all this kind of stuff. So I was just really deeply rooted into all of it. And then a great thing about living here and then having this interest is I have a pretty easy accessibility to information about the conflict and what happened. So I'm able to look up stuff that would be harder, say, for you or for other people to get at because it's here. Like, I could walk, well, I couldn't walk, but I could drive over to a neighboring library and I could see original John Quincy Adams and John Adams papers and documents about when he was president. In other parts of the countries, they have that kind of stuff. They have presidential libraries or whatever. But this is in a public library. Anyone can go, and you can't just pick up the documents. I mean, they're original documents and stuff. But you can go, and they put them on display, and you can learn about it and read stuff. And usually most people, if you want to have this kind of cool, amazing firsthand experience with any of this kind of stuff, the place you have to go is Washington, D.C. Because nowhere else, in my mind, is there this great preponderance of stuff in such a small space. So it's everywhere.
Yes, indeed. And if you ever make it down to D.C., Jonathan, to visit some of the historical museums, give me a call and I'll meet you there.
That would be awesome.
I'll give you a bit of a tour. It's not necessarily, I haven't spent a lot of time in D.C., but there is a lot of stuff there.
I've been there twice, but my wife has never been. So I keep on telling her one of these days we're going to take a trip down there. And one of the times I went down was for a funeral of a great uncle of mine who, he served in World War II. He was in the OSS, which was the precursor to the CIA. He was in the CIA. He was one of the first individuals into Hitler's Eagle's Nest. And when I went down for his funeral, he was buried actually in Arlington National Cemetery. So I got to, like, we could take a tour of Arlington, got to go into some of the Smithsonians and stuff. And I loved it down there. I loved the transit system and everything. I was like, DC's my kind of place. It's cool. And one of the things I liked the most about it was how there are so many great museums in such a small area. So you could really hit them up. And they just have so much stuff that's cool and accessible. Everything from Mr. Rogers' sweater and the Fonzie's jacket to all sorts of airplanes and things brought back from the moon and everything. Just so cool. And to be able to access that and learn about it, I think it's amazing. Like, you can probably tell I have this unquestionable thirst for knowledge and information and to, like, just constantly learn more.
Well, it's been an experience for me. About 5 years ago, I moved to East Coast from the West Coast, and there's not the same environment on the West Coast at all. But honestly, Jonathan, how much of your interest in the Rev War is because of the cool uniforms and those nifty tricorn hats?
You gotta love the tricorn hats. You really do.
And the flintlock muskets.
That's true. They don't make them like that anymore, do they?
No, they don't. You've talked a lot about figure painting, specifically how little you enjoy figure painting. So you like the uniforms, you like the muskets. What is it that you don't like about painting? I know it takes you a lot of time, but it just seems like those little Revolutionary War figures would be something you could really get into spending some time and enjoy painting.
Well, I got to back up for a second. As much as I do think the uniforms are cool, and it's hard for me to resist admiring someone in uniform that's well-kempt, for me, the thing with the Rev War, I think, really is a story behind it. The plot, the fact that it was important for human history, not only because for the first time it made this lasting impression on mankind that people, despite all the odds, the ultimate underdog is able to succeed, get its freedom, and say, this is what it is, and make something better than the sum of its parts. And the fact that then dominoed into the French Revolution and the monarchy over there, and all the way even to modern times with the war in Vietnam, it all can be traced back to the American Revolution. Now, the odd thing is, and perhaps something that might get some bit of feedback from people, is that I've thought about this quite a bit. And if I were alive at the time of the American Revolution, I would have been a Tory. I would have been like, wait a sec. You're rebelling against our lawful king just because he's been busy with other stuff, so we've had some fair bit of autonomy, and you don't want to give it up. Every other colony has to give it up. Why are we special? At the time, I would have been like, you're just a bunch of whiny kids. What's going on? Stop being a brat. And let's obey mom and dad and do what we're supposed to do. And people probably think it's odd that being someone who lives here where I do, and of course being an American like you, that I would be like, I'd be British. Let's go back to Britain and move on to that. So it's probably very controversial for me to say. But it's true. I side with England in the American Revolution, which is really odd. And yet, despite that, when I game the American Rev, I don't game as the side of the Brits. I game as my version of the Americans, which is really, really weird and probably illogical. But when it, oh, yeah.
Well, you do spend more time looking at your opponent's figures. So maybe it's just because, you know, the British really did have better uniforms. By playing the Americans, it gives you more opportunity to admire your opponent's, amazing paint jobs with their red coats.
That, you know what? That must be it.
Have you tried any of the quick painting methods some of your figures?
It's funny because I want to like painting, and when I'm in the groove, I can get some enjoyment out of it. And it's ironic because I oil paint landscapes, but for whatever reason, I can't sit my butt in a chair and hunch over a model, no matter how big or small it is, and spend hour after hour painting it. I can't base coat the thing and prime it, not in that order, of course, and then dip it into the Army Painter Quick Shade. Even though Quick Shade is amazing, you literally dip your model in or apply by paintbrush, depending on which camp you reside in, and then shake off the excess, and you set it down for 24 hours and don't do anything with it, and you're basically done. Despite the fact that it's a dip method, I don't want to be bothered with putting the model together. I don't want to be modeled with making sure it's glued right. Or even if it's not glued, I don't want to be bothered with being like, okay, let me get the brown, let me get the green, and base coat this and do that. And I think maybe some of it comes from the fact that it does take me a really long time to get the piece to a level where I'm happy, which is very rudimentary. Like, anyone else that I've ever happened to come across who paints, who considers themselves to not be good, is able to do what I do in a lot less time. I like to give this example. There's, in Flames of War, one of the things you need to paint, in addition to the models that make up your army, are objective markers. And rather than saying, this spot over here on the table, or outlining it with something, with tokens or whatever, rather than doing that, you buy a model that you either have to put together depending on what model it is, and then you paint it. So because of my love of the Battle of the Bulge movie, even though it's not historically accurate at all, but because of my love of that, there's a scene at the end where the Germans are advancing and they're running out of fuel, so they need to take this fuel dump away from the Americans, and it blows up. Glorious explosions everywhere, and the Germans at the last second are denied that vital fuel, which means the Allies can defeat them and win the war. Because of that, I thought it'd be really cool to buy the fuel dump and ammo dump objective markers for Flames of War. I painted the first Flames of War fuel dump objective marker from A to Z, soup to nuts, to a level where I was happy. That's just a basic level, nothing fancy, nothing amazing, 12 hours. If it's going to take me 12 hours for an objective marker, then forget it with everything else. And I know, like, an objective marker, you probably is better likened to that showpiece figure, like a general or something like that, instead of your rank and file. But even doing things like assembly line method painting, and knowing that really I'm not supposed to be painting it for 3 inches away from my eye, it's for the 3 to 4 foot method, because who's really going to get down, hunch over on a table, and stand that close to your models to look at them? No one. But even knowing all that, it takes me forever to paint. And maybe part of it is that for a long, long time, I never had a dedicated painting space. So I always had to set up stuff, something temporary, do the painting, take it down, put it away, then bring it back out again. A lot of work involved with that. And that may have diminished my enjoyment with painting. Now, part of it's just laziness. Part of it's that I don't have to paint anymore because the guys I game with, they paint. They like to paint. They'll do the painting and I do other stuff. And part of it is because I'm podcasting so much.
Well, that's interesting. A lot of war gamers talk about the percentages of how they enjoy their hobby time or how they actually spend their hobby time. And a lot of people, will give a percentage to the time they spend modeling and painting and then a percentage to how much they spend wargaming. And it's great that it sounds like you're spending more time wargaming than painting. And it's great that you're gaming with guys that are willing and actually enjoy the painting part. But you do spend a lot of time podcasting as well, and not just producing your own podcast, but listening to other podcasts, reading magazines, which kind of ties into what you do with the podcast. How would you kind of divide your time, on a 100% scale or a ratio, or fractions, however it makes sense to you? But how do you divide, kind of see, like, just an average week? How much of your time do you spend painting and modeling? How much time gaming, and how much time either thinking or actually working on your podcast?
To be fair, it's pretty impossible for me to do anything less than the amount of time I spend painting, which would be none.
So that's a big zero.
That would be a big fat zero. And as time goes by, I'm realizing that I'm spending less and less time playing games and more time not playing games. So I used to, when I was gaming, before even wargaming, when in like the glory days of my gaming, which are now gone, it's sad. I'm only 31, my glory days are past me, which is really sad. But in my glory days of gaming, when I was
especially when you didn't have money to buy a whole lot of cool figures when you were in college, yes.
Despite that, I don't know how, but I managed to get some stuff anyway. And in those times, I would be out every night of the week. I'd be playing games roughly from either dinner time or right after to 4 or 5 in the morning. Every night, I would just go to the game store, hang out, play games nonstop, one right after another. And then weekends, I'd repeat it. I'd get up in the morning and meet up with friends, go to the game store, and we would spend the day, all day Saturday, all day Sunday, unless I like had to work or whatever. I'd be at the game store gaming. I was gaming all the time. And then it transitioned to where every Wednesday night I would go gaming. I'd meet up with a bunch of guys, we'd go at the game store, and we'd game from like 6:30 or 7 to, I don't know, 10, maybe 11 if it was a late night. And then that slowly became, well, every other week or once a month. And now what it's become is that I try to get people to come to my house once a month or ideally every other week, which doesn't always happen, and show up and we play games for like 4 or 5 hours. Or rather, we play a game, because historical war gamers know that you're lucky to get a game done in 4 or 5 hours, because many of our games take a very long time. So weekly, it would be really hard for me to break it down because, like I said, I don't paint. So that's a zero. And then for many weeks, I don't game. So that would be a zero. But if you look at it overall, if I were to kind of like average everything out and put it all together, I would say that 0% of my time I paint. No, actually, that's not true. I would have to say 1% of my time I paint or do hobby related things like that. Because, I mean, really, for it to average out to zero, it would have to be zero all the time, and that's just not going to happen. And then the next lowest number would be the amount of time I actually play games. So I'm just going to make up a number, and I'm going to say that's maybe 30% of my gaming life is playing games. Then the next slot would be podcasting. And there's a fourth slot, too, a fourth category that you didn't mention, but a very important fourth category. So the next spot would be podcasting. Everything from, like you said, me actually recording like we are now, or, well, not now for the listeners because they're listening to it, so we're done recording. But the actual recordings and the coming up with the show ideas and booking guests and all that kind of stuff and doing all the work, creating show notes and editing and all the fun and unfun side of podcasting. And I would say, well, see, this is a hard one because I do more than one show, which really makes it difficult. One show's weekly. It's a half an hour at most. And I spend maybe an hour, hour and a half extra doing things like coming up with ideas and all that other stuff that goes into it. And then Wargaming Recon being once a month, not once a month, used to be, once every other week, it's not as frequent, but it's a longer show. It's an hour show. So I'm spending, oh, it's awful. I'm probably spending 3 to 4 hours per episode on work for that episode, whether it's recording or doing other stuff. But then there's another category that doesn't really tie necessarily into the podcasting, but it's the category of time I spend finding new games for me to get excited about, which I may or may not ever play, but ones that I needless have to get everyone around me excited about so that they will buy and then want to play. And that is where I spend most of my time, finding something new and shiny on the internet that sounds really cool. And, hey, guys, did you know about this? We should get this. This is really cool. No, I'm not going to buy stuff necessarily, but if you do, I'll play it. Yeah, I'm one of those people, unfortunately.
Right.
I'll play right. anything if someone else provides the materials needed for me to play it. If I have to, I need to really think long and hard. Like, how often am I going to be able to do this? And do I have the capital to spend on it? Which is why I'm stuck with the American Revolution and Black Powder right now, or Black Powder derivatives. Although I'm actually branching out into Maurice a little bit. There's a campaign that's supposed to be going on that thankfully I'm not running. A guy named Adam, who is amazing, has his own blog, the Fencing Frog blog at blogspot.com or something like that. And he's really into Maurice. So he thankfully has all the stuff needed to play. So I don't have to buy the rules or anything. But I'm liking it enough that I could see myself maybe starting an army and not painting it, but playing with it and buying the rules and everything like that. So all told, if you look at the pie and you figure out how much is pie that I ate and how much is left and all that kind of stuff, I'm going to say like the world's tiniest sliver of pie is my painting. And then I'm going to say half to two thirds of the pie is me being excited about stuff and getting people to buy it. And then the next largest chunk is all the podcasting. And I find that the podcasting takes up more and more time every day I look at it. I keep on thinking, oh, I could do this better, or there's that should be done. And I'm underutilizing my Twitter account, and I should really have a presence, like a really good presence on G+ and on Pinterest. So I need to take those seriously, which means that's like another 9 hours of my life on that each week. So I'm finding like it just grows and grows and grows for that. And then there's the gaming, which would be the second smallest pie. The hard thing with all of this is that this is supposed to be what we do for fun, to relax, and a hobby. And I don't know about you, but I don't make a living off of this. And I don't know anyone who really makes a living off being a wargamer. So that means like we still have to find time to do things like work a real job and eat and go to sleep and bathe, because that's really important, especially at conventions. And spending time with our loved ones and our friends and everything. So when you look at the overall pie chart of life and what one can do and what one can't, it's sad, but more and more it feels like for me that things like actually gaming and that kind of stuff ends up getting shuffled to the bottom of the list.
Well, there must be some other non-wargaming activities that you engage in that are not just sleeping, bathing, and working. What other things do you like to do with your time?
Eat ice cream.
Do you have a favorite flavor?
Oh, God. I did. And I hesitate to mention it.
Does it change on a regular basis?
Well, I was just thinking, I did a whole episode on my other show, Geeks Explicitly, about this, and I hesitate to mention it because Geeks Explicitly, unlike Wargaming Recon, Wargaming Recon's a family-friendly show, try to keep things PG-13 or less. Geeks Explicitly has no boundaries. Anything and everything goes. If you're familiar with 4chan, the B-board, random board, it's like that. Or at least in theory, it's like that. Usually, it's just an occasional swear. But this particular episode, I really go far out on my love of ice cream, and not in like a weird bad way, but there's just a lot of stuff there that would never ever be allowed onto an episode of Wargaming Recon. But I did do an episode all about my love of ice cream on how I geek out about ice cream. As to a favorite flavor, I can't say I have just one. I'm a huge fan of anything peanut butter. Peanut butter is not so great for you, even though it has tons of protein, and we can thank George Washington Carver for all that he has done with the peanut and its ability to make a tasty, tasty treat. And I would be remiss if I didn't express my love of chocolate. So chocolate ice cream and peanut butter ice cream, I like, but it can't be a peanut butter flavor ice cream. It can have peanut butter in it or peanut butter cups, because they are wonderful in that they blend chocolate and peanut butter together. But peanut and peanut butter flavored ice cream, not for me. And vanilla to me is a waste of time. Like, why bother eating it at all? Now, ice cream, when I talk about ice cream, I have to say my love is with soft serve, which most people dismiss as just crap you get like on the boardwalk or whatever. But I am so thankful that next door to where I work is, in my opinion, the world's best ice cream shop that makes fantastic custom homemade soft serve ice cream. It's Truly Yogurt. I talk about them all the time on Twitter and with people. I actually have a running kind of joke with some podcasters out in Arizona who do the Game Night Guys podcast, which is a great podcast. I highly recommend it. And I have this running joke with them about my love of ice cream. So every now and then I use Foursquare, and every now and then I don't realize that an update on Foursquare means that Foursquare is automatically published into Twitter whenever I check in somewhere. And next thing I know, there's like 20 check-ins at Truly Yogurt, and the Game Night guys are like, what flavor you get today? And so I have to keep them up to date on my flavors. I'm probably the only person I know who pays for ice cream by check, because the place takes cash or check. I never have cash on me. They won't take debit card. And I just buy so much ice cream. It's really unhealthy. They know me by name. They know my usual, which is sad when an ice cream place, first of all, when you have a usual at an ice cream place, and then when they know what it is, that's just awful. My go-to flavors there is an odd combination. It used to be black raspberry soft serve with chocolate soft serve, half and half. And then on days they wouldn't have black raspberry, I would get the hard ice cream black raspberry with chocolate soft serve, half and half. I've since moved on and expanded my horizons so that I get black raspberry chip ice cream and chocolate soft serve half and half. I'll walk in and I'll say to the owner, whose name is Gary, I'll say, Gary, I don't really know what I want today. Can I try the flavor of the day? Every day they have a different flavor. Can I try this? Can I try that? And he indulges me, partly I think because he likes me and partly because I spend way too much money there. But after I try everything, I say, I still don't know what I want. And he'll turn to me and say, I can guess what you might want. Let me guess, something with black raspberry and chocolate in it. And I'll look at him and say, that sounds like good. How about you fix me up something like one of my usuals? And he'll do it, and I walk away a happy camper. I should note that when I'm really bad, I go there 3 to 4 times a week. And I told my wife actually the other day that if we lived far away from them, if we lived in another part of the state where it would take me 3 or 4 hours to get there, I would still go there at least once a week to get ice cream.
Well, for a second, when you said 3 to 4 times, I thought you were going to say a day. So it's not completely to the point of pure obsession.
I shouldn't admit it, but I have been back there more than once in a day.
An occasional special treat.
And even when I get ice cream there, like I'll eat it at work while I'm working. And then I'll come home and there'll be ice cream at home. So I'll eat ice cream at home. I make my own ice cream. I make my own whipped cream. And like also, like I really go crazy about ice cream. So much so that people have said I should podcast about ice cream. And I have to reply, I'm not a foodie. And I don't have the time to do a third podcast. I had a third podcast and then I had to kill it. So that's what's going to go on with ice cream. But I love ice cream, as evidenced by the fact that I've talked about it for what, like 10 minutes? But aside of that, I love reading. I love playing computer games. I'm really addicted to a game called Prison Architect, which I did a whole show on Geeks Explicitly. In case you're not getting the hint, anything that's not wargaming or New England gaming related that I love, that's somehow related to gaming or geekiness, I talk about on my other show. So I just kind of think, is this appropriate for Wargaming Recon? If yes, make a note and I record about it someday. If no, make a note, and I talk about it on Geeks Explicitly. And that's what it's like with Prison Architect. But I love all sorts of computer games, video games, reading. I mentioned that I like to do oil landscape painting. I'm a huge fan of Bob Ross. And in case you don't know who he is, he's that painting guy who's now dead, but he used to be on PBS with the big Brillo pad hair, and he talked really softly, happy trees, happy trees. Let's have a happy mountain next to the happy trees. And as a kid, I don't know why, but I loved watching it, and I wanted to paint like him. So one day after I was married, I said to my wife, I've always wanted to do this since I was a kid, and I don't care. I'm going to do it. So I took lessons, and I bought paints, and I'm not saying I'm good or anything, but I do it, and I have fun. We have some pets. I spend time with my wife. I like to walk, actually. I think it's far too often with gamers that they're either under or overweight, and I fall in the latter category, which, of course, is unhealthy. So I try to eat better, and I try to go out for walks during my lunch breaks at work and do things like that. But generally, I'm really like an indoor kind of guy. You're not going to find me hanging out outside or camping or hiking or any of those ING things that involve being in the outdoors where there are bugs and stuff that will find you. And I have a big fear of spiders. A funny story, which probably is going to emasculate me in front of everyone, and I should probably keep it to myself, but I think people like self-deprecating humor. So before I was married, I was talking with my wife.
I like that I didn't even have to prompt you or beg you to go ahead and tell it. You're just going to go ahead and tell it. Please do.
You know what? If I'm not going to make fun of myself, who else is? And then really part of it is maybe self-preservation, because if I pull the punch first, it takes a sting out of it when someone else does.
Sure it does.
So before I was married, my wife and I, we would talk about stuff like what was important to us and all sorts of different things, kind of like fill each other out and like learn stuff. I remember my mom telling me that before her and my dad was married, she liked to know what way he liked the toilet paper. Was it so that it pulled down from in front, or was it backwards? And did he, like, how far did he squeeze out his toothpaste and that kind of stuff? Like, stupid little things, but it's the little things that really matter when you're living in close proximity to someone, whether you're married to them or not. So my wife, who wasn't my wife at the time, my fiance at the time, and I, we were talking about all sorts of stuff. And out of the blue, I said, so are you afraid of spiders? No. How about bugs? No. Okay. Well, your job will be after we are married, after we're wed, one of your responsibilities, if you will agree to this, is that you need to be the person to kill the bugs that come into wherever we live, in particular spiders, but all bugs. And she has always had a hard time telling when I'm being serious and when I'm joking. And maybe part of it is because I can just do things so deadpan. In my head, I'll be like, ha ha ha, it's so funny. And I'll just have a straight face. But I firmly believe she thought I was joking. So she said yes without missing a beat. And I thought, oh, thank you. I don't have to worry about this anymore because I hate spiders and you'll just kill them all. And I'll tell you, I'll say, Trisha, there's a spider here. How about you kill it? And that'll take care of all my problems in life, because at the time, that felt like the biggest problem I had, that spiders would come and try to, like, I would swallow. Did you know people over the course of our lives, we swallow 3 spiders, which is really disturbing to me. We do that while we sleep, and no matter what, spider for some reason decides our mouth is a great place to hang out, and then we swallow it, which is really disturbing to me.
My wife has shared this same piece of trivia with me. You should tell your wife, though, that you're doing her a bit of a favor, that you just go ahead and ask her to kill the spider, because I'm the spider killer in my house, and my wife is usually insistent on the fact that I somehow try to capture the spider and then put my shoes on and go outside and release it into the wild.
Well, my wife agreed to my request, and I was surprised but pleasantly so. And then after we were married, we were living in an apartment, and there was a spider on the wall. So I told her. I remembered that she said she would kill it, she'd take care of them. And I went up to her and I said, there's a spider on the wall. She said, okay, good, go kill it. And I looked at her like she shattered my world. I was like, what? No, your job.
Did you get that in a prenup agreement somewhere?
I really thought like everything was ironed out. And she's like, you're a grown boy, go kill the spider yourself. And I'm like, no, you promised. And it was at that moment that I realized she thought I was joking. So whenever I see a spider or a bug now, although I've kind of backed off on bugs, but spiders in particular, whenever I see a spider, I'll be like, there's a spider over there. You got a friend on the ceiling. And I prod her for it. And now she just kind of sighs and she's like, really? You can't just go kill it yourself. Like, be a man. But she goes and does it. So that may make me less of a man to everyone else. And maybe. But I don't care because she kills our spiders, which is all that matters.
It sounds like a good match then.
It was a long time coming. And she tried different things, actually. Like, at one point, she'd be like, no. And then she came up on the bright idea that maybe if she bought some sort of spider killing spray, that I could handle that because I wouldn't have to touch the spider or come too close to it. And that maybe it wouldn't chase me because, like, I could just spray it to death. So she bought a spray for me to use. And I would use it. And it was one of those, like, healthy for plants and stuff. And she picked it because we have some pets. We have, at that time, we only had one bunny, and then we got a second bunny. And we now have other pets, too. But she figured if it's safe for plants, it's safe for rabbits. She's since changed her mind and decided that anything that's going to kill something living is probably not safe for a bunny. So I'm not allowed to use that, which means I just ask her to kill the bugs more often. So it might be helping out our rabbits. I'm not really sure, but if it is, it's not helping her out because I'm like, there's a bug here and a bug there. And the funny thing is, like, I don't like to go outside, but I've discovered a love of grilling. My dad would always cook out in the warm weather. And I don't like to cook. I like to bake, oddly enough. I like to bake and that kind of stuff. But I'm not someone who's going to be like, let me make chicken cacciatore or whatever. But the idea of us having a house and then buying a grill just made sense and felt right. So I was like, we should buy a grill. So we ended up getting a grill. And I was like, I think I'll like it, but I don't know how much I'll like it. Well, lo and behold, I'm like, let's grill this. And can I grill that? And how about this? And oh, maybe this would be good on the grill. And looking up recipes and stuff. And then I discovered one day when I was taking the cover off the grill, a gigantic spider in there. And I really thought for a moment, what do I do? Do I get Trisha to come and take care of it? No, she's not home right now. So do I just pretend I didn't see it and put it back on top of the grill and don't grill at all or what? And then I had a huge moment for me. I felt like my heart grew three sizes that day. I decided I was going to be a man and I was going to take the cover, fling it away from the grill, but I would still be out there and grill. So although I didn't deal with the spider directly, I didn't kill it or remove it or put it anywhere safe. I didn't run screaming like a girl, which would be good. And I stayed out there. I actually grilled. I forgot about it. And I was like, whatever. There's a spider over there. What do I care? I'm just going to do my grilling and go back inside. So I felt like that was a huge moment of growth for me.
What are the names of your bunnies?
So we have two bunnies. And, well, I was trying to decide how much of a backstory do I want to give you about give everyone about the bunnies. And I guess I'll just give it all. When we got married, after we got married, I was like, we should get a pet. And I've always been a dog person, and my wife's a cat person. But unfortunately for her, I'm allergic to cats. So she knew that on the day we married, she would never be able to have another cat while I'm alive. And I've told her that when I die, I'm going to come back and haunt her. So
as a cat?
No. That would be really weird. No, I'll just be, I'm going to be this poltergeist thing, and I'm just going to come and be like, so what are you doing today? And, oh, look, you got a cat. Do you think that's going to keep me away? Maybe, maybe not, because I'm a ghost. So what does it matter? But, no, seriously, though, I'm allergic to cats. And we were trying to decide what to get as a pet. And I was like, oh, we could get a dog. And I'm like, I don't want a dog. Because, like I want a dog. But we just got married, and I have this responsibility of learning of what it is to be a husband. And I'm not going to have time to take a dog for a walk and all that kind of stuff. So let's think smaller, something more manageable. And then I came on the great idea of getting a hamster. I was like, a hamster's small and lives in a little thing and it's fine. My wife's like, I can't bond with a hamster. It's tiny. You know, it's not real, really. It's not going to live very long. I can't invest myself in something that's going to die in a couple years. And I was like, okay, so what do you suggest? And I wasn't really sure what she was going to come up with. And I'm thinking, well, what else can you get that's going to be manageable and live in something small? And that we could bond with, but will live a while. Because small things don't live very long. Well, she came up with the idea of bunnies. I was like, okay, that's cool. So we went out one day, and we went to a pet store, and we saw some bunnies, and they were really cool. And then I looked at the price. I was like, they want how much for a rabbit? It's like $50 for a bunny. I'm thinking, that's ridiculous. Who's going to spend $50 on a rabbit? And we found out that they got the bunnies from a nearby farm, but we didn't know how to get to the farm. So my wife was off from work that day, and I think I took the day off or something like that. And she called, at my insistence, she called her work. Because my theory is whenever you have a question, no matter what it is, even if it doesn't seem like it's going to pertain to this, when in doubt, call the library because they know the answer or how to get the answer.
Yes, indeed.
So I said, call the library. Call our local library. I'm not calling where you work to ask them where this is. Well, call where you work. You work in a library. Maybe one of your friends there can look it up. So one of her friends looked it up, and we went to the farm and found this tiny little fluff ball, this black and white bunny that they were calling Oreo. And my wife at the time was like, I like the idea of getting a bunny, but I don't want to get something right now. She felt she wasn't ready for it right now. She was like, maybe, you know, 6 months or a year, whatever we will. Well, then the guy who owns the farm, it's a family business, a great farm, Sweet Meadow Farms. So if you ever need hay or food for small animals or anything, they ship online and everything. They're amazing. So we went there, and the owner brought this little fluff ball over in this tiny, tiny little basket, and brought this fluff ball over to my wife and sat it in my wife's lap, and the bunny looked up at her, and that was it. She melted, and I knew at that moment we were walking home with a bunny. So we were like, let's think about it overnight and stuff, and I woke up like extra early the next day, almost like it was Christmas. I was so excited I couldn't sleep. We decided we were going to get the bunny, and we got stuff we needed, and we decided Oreo is a stupid name for a rabbit. So we renamed this little black and white fluff ball Sally. And I don't really remember why or how we came up with the name Sally. But Sally is this little mini lop rabbit. So she's not that big of a bunny. Some bunnies grow pretty big. But she's a manageable size. And lops are the ones that have the ears that go down, which I think are cuter than the ones with the ears that go up. And that might just be personal preference. I'm not really sure on that. But adorable. And so we had Sally for a while, and just had her. And then I would go back to the farm to get food for Sally. Hay and stuff, because she was raised on it. And we were like, we should get what she was raised on because they prefer it. And thankfully, I work not too far from the farm. So I would go. And then one day, I happened to see that they had some other bunnies. And I was like, oh, these bunnies are so cute. So I would stop by from time to time just to go say hi to the bunnies and to pat them. And one of the bunnies, I kept on going back and seeing, I was like, oh, this bunny's so cute. And I got to know the people at the farm. And this bunny is a black bunny, adorable mini lop rabbit. And the people at the farm said that they got him not long ago because some people returned him. That they had bought him from the farm and they were moving and they couldn't bring him with them to where they were moving to. And I was like, what? Who moves? Who has a pet and then moves to a place where they're not going to allow pets? What kind of person does that? And I'm like, they returned this bunny. Who returns a bunny? So, of course, in my head, I'm thinking, this is a cute bunny. I like this bunny. Can we get another bunny? I don't know. And I formulate the plan of mentioning it to my wife. And I'm like, so I went to the farm, and there was this bunny there. It's really cute, but can you believe he was returned? And she starts to melt. She's like, they brought back a bunny? And I tell her what I was told, how the people were moving, and they moved to a place where they couldn't allow bunnies, and she's outraged. She's like, what kind of animal owner is going to abandon their animal? And I was like, I don't know. So I was like, do you want to go see the bunny? They have other treats and stuff there that we can look to. And she's like, okay. So we went, and I don't think she had any intention of us getting another bunny. But we went, and it was love at first sight. Her and this other bunny, she's like, we got to bring him home. So we ended up with this other bunny. And it's interesting. I'm laughing because they have really distinct personalities, which I never would have imagined. One, bunnies being able to do all the things they can do, all the tricks and the training you can do with them, and all the personalities. And now this bunny, my wife had a name in mind. She wanted to call the bunny Mal. And I was like, Mal? And my geek mind is thinking, I piece it together. She wants to call him Mal after the character from Firefly, the great Joss Whedon TV series that got canceled unjustly by Fox. And she wants to call him Mal. I'm like, I'm not calling him Mal. And I was like, well, how about Malcolm? Because Mal's name technically is Malcolm Reynolds. So how about we call the bunny Malcolm? And she thought about that, and she's like, I like that. So we have a black mini lop bunny named Malcolm, and we have a white, black and white mini lop bunny named Sally. And the interesting thing is, they are brother and sister. They were from the same litter, from the same place, which we didn't necessarily know at the time. They lived together, and we've had them for, now they're what, 3-4 years old? And they're amazing little bunnies. We have learned a couple things about them, that Sally really seems to be extra affectionate towards me, and she's not always so nice to Malcolm, which is interesting. And that, for whatever reason, I don't know why, but like Sally is really bonded with me, but she's kind of a bit of a brat. She likes to be adventuresome and get into things that she shouldn't get into, which has caused her to get into some precarious situations. Once they live in this dog exercise pen. It's huge, gives them more space to run around and get space to spread out and everything. And at first we didn't have a cover for it until one day I happened to see that she was perching on top of it. Somehow or other, she had jumped up there and couldn't figure out how to get down, and she was scaring herself. So we decided we had to get a cover on. And no matter what you do, she will find a way to get into something that she shouldn't. Rabbits can jump like 4 to 5 times their height. So if you look at a little bunny and you think, oh, it's just tiny, it's not going to do much, know that that little bunny can jump anywhere from 4 to 6 feet in the air, which is really amazing to see. And then we've learned that Malcolm is kind of an emo bunny, because he gets like really sad at times, and he really can, or at least it seems like he really feels what like we're feeling. So if we're happy, he's like, yay, I'm so happy. And if something's bothering him, he gets like sad and sulks. So it's really interesting. You can look at them and you just see him over there, and he just looks so sad and depressed, and you're like, what's wrong? And like, you gotta go and console him so he's not all sad. And then you get the other one who just gets into all sorts of trouble because she's so adventuresome. And it's really a weird dynamic, but I feel that it is going to prepare us for someday when we have kids, because I've learned from having all sorts of little cousins that kids are so different than you would ever imagine them to be. Like, you might think that the kid's going to be like such and such and do certain things, and they do the exact opposite, and they're just completely different people. So if we ever have more than one kid or whatever, I think we're getting some experience, oddly enough, with having bunnies that are completely different types of rabbits from one another. It's really something to see. Of course, the downside of having bunnies is that they don't have vocal cords per se, so they don't make noises like that. They might like make little groany sounds or something like that, but they make noises in other ways with toys and banging on things and stuff. So when we first got them, we were in a really tiny one-bedroom apartment, and I podcasted mere feet away from where the bunnies lived. And then when we were in a small condo, mere feet away from where the bunnies were, one-bedroom condo, open floor plan, right next to it. And whenever they would make noise, you could hear them on the podcast. And I could have either spent hours and hours and hours trying to edit that out, or I could have done what I did and embraced it and said, they're here, that's what it is, it doesn't matter. If you don't like it, ignore it. Otherwise, they're bonus content for the show. And now that we have our house, the bunnies live in the living room because they've been so used to being with us with all the activity that if they're not at the where everything's happening, they get lonely. So some people who are really into having bunnies give them their own room. But for us, they are in where everything's happening. And then I've moved myself away into an office/podcast studio. So hopefully it's quieter without any of the bunny kind of sounds coming in.
I definitely thought it was interesting. One of the first times I heard you mentioning the bunnies in the background on one of your episodes of Wargaming Recon, and I was like, bunnies, what's the story with that? So I had to, I'm glad you shared that. I had to know. Interesting that it started with you just being allergic to cats, but it sounds like you've really taken to them. I think almost with you know, any pet, you know, probably even a hamster, your wife might feel differently after some time with a couple hamsters.
I've been told
and
that,
seeing their personalities emerge.
I've been told that generally speaking, there are more households that have dogs than people who have cats, but there are more cats as pets than dogs, because people who are dog people get a dog, usually. There's one dog and that's that. People who are cat people get multiple cats. And I think people who are bunny people, in many ways, bunnies behave like cats from what my wife tells me. And that people who are bunny people get more than one rabbit. And we belong to these different, like, rabbit prevention, cruelty prevention organizations and things start promoting, like, education and what are good things to do with rabbits and nutrition and all that kind of stuff. And we get a lot of material from them. And a lot of it is that they're trying to adopt bunnies out to people. So whenever we see something like that, I can tell my wife's looking and she'll say, well, what do you think about another bunny? Would they get along? And really having more than one bunny, it's kind of like having a bunny marriage because the bunnies have to bond. They have to become like best friends. And if they don't, they could just as easily turn on each other and get into a huge fight. And the next thing you know, you have one less bunny. So you really have to do your homework and take it really slow and make sure that they like get along famously. So introducing a second bunny is hard. Introducing a third bunny is even harder because it has to get along not just with one other bunny, but two. But somehow people have many bunnies, and I don't know how they do it, but they do. And I have to say, yeah, ours live in a confined space, but they're a lot of work. It's worth it, completely worth it, but they are so much more work than I ever thought they would be, and they're so much more interesting than I ever thought they would be.
I think actually you should name this episode All About Bunnies and Ice Cream. I actually need to, I have more questions for you, but I think that might be a good place to stop. I actually am going to need to leave soon. So.
Well, it sounds to me like maybe there's a part two of this coming out at some point.
Yeah. I almost think we could do another episode. I really wanted to ask you about kind of your future plans for your shows and your future hopes for wargaming. But that could lead in. And also I wanted to talk about Star Wars a little bit more too and how that's kind of related to wargaming. But I think that could actually be a whole nother show.
People who know me personally, I probably would be surprised about hearing any of these podcast episodes because I am an introvert. So I'm not someone who's really outgoing or talkative with most people in real life. Once I feel comfortable with someone and I basically feel like they've earned my trust, I open up and I just go on and on and on. But with podcasting, for whatever reason, whether it's because I'm not face-to-face with someone or I'm talking to a microphone and not a person, I don't know what the reason is. But once you get me going, I'm like the Energizer Bunny. You can't shut me up. I just keep on going and going and going. So you could ask me one little tiny thing, and then 4 hours later, I'm still talking about it.
No, it's great. It made it easy for me once you got rolling. Once I got over the the introduction and the first question or two, you did all the work. You did all the heavy lifting, so that's great.
Well, I know you want to wrap up my guest appearance here, but one quick tiny story kind of tied into this. I recently was a guest on a Google Plus video podcast hangout thing for the Ruthless Diastema podcast. And the episode was titled Wargaming 101 with Jonathan Reinhardt. And the host asked me to come on as like the expert guest. And I'm thinking, me? You must be crazy because there are people who are way better than I am. And this person had like an outline that they wanted to share with me about what they wanted to cover on the show, which I thought was really nice. I have to say, I don't do that with any of my guests. I say, we're going to talk about whatever topic, whether it's something that they, a game they made or something. Like with Henry Hyde, for example, I was like, let's talk about Miniatures Wargaming and your book that's coming out. And that's it. I wasn't like, we're going to cover this, this, and this. I was like, that's what we're doing and jumping into the deep end and that's that. But the host of Ruthless Diastema, Pete Figtree, was like, oh, here's this stuff. And are there more things I should ask you, more questions? And he's like, I'm really sorry. It's really short. And I was like, listen, Pete, I could do an hour easily on just three of your questions right there in the beginning. And he's like, really? And it's like, yeah, you want me to be on for an hour? So don't worry about it. So, you know, I was on the show and we did stuff and we didn't get through everything and we talked for an hour and a half. So it just kind of goes to show that I really won't shut up. You need to be like, okay, we're done now. Moving on. And that's one of the reasons why when I do the show on my own, Like, I have a list and I have to keep on reminding myself, stay on target, stay on target. A little Star Wars reference for you. So that I'm like, did I cover this? Did I cover this? Okay, look. Oh, wait, I'm on for 40 minutes, 45 minutes. I have time for a little bit more. Oh, wait, I can't cover this because I'll run out of time. So I really have to pay attention to that and stay aware of it because, I mean, look, I just talked another 10 minutes after. You're like, we got to wrap this up.
I'm actually looking forward to seeing how long, once you release your 100th episode with the 100 tips for wargaming, how long it's going to take you to actually get through 100 tips.
Well, there's a reason why I said tips have to be short. They need to be brief. One sentence.
They have to be short, but that's not going to necessarily limit your commentary, is it?
Oh, geez. You know, I haven't decided how I'm going to do it. I don't know if I'm just going to read them off and be like, so-and-so from such-and-such says blah, blah, blah. Or I'm going to be like, there's this tip from so-and-so, and they say, etc. Well, that's, I think this about this, and like extrapolate on that. Or not. I really don't know because I find, and this is awful for me to say, and this is probably a bad place to end this, but we're going to end it there anyway. I find, for me personally, I will not listen to a podcast if it's more than 20 minutes to half an hour in length. I don't care how great it is. I don't care who's on it. George Lucas could be on there and could be inviting me to submit content. I will not listen to him talk for more than 20 minutes to half an hour. And yet, I'll listen to a half-hour podcast, and I'll listen to 5 or 6 episodes in a row. It makes no sense. It's completely illogical, but that's how it is. And I find that for any of my shows that are more than an hour, it's really hard for me to stay motivated to do all the post-production for it. The general rule of thumb in podcasting is that if you look at whatever the recorded time is, if it takes an hour for actual playing time, that it's anywhere between 2 to 3 times minimum that in order to do all the post-production, everything from editing on. So all those people who do 3-4 hour shows, they're looking at 12 hours or more of editing and other stuff for post-production. I don't have that kind of time. I can't be spending 24 hours working on whatever. So I try to limit myself to an hour. And my guess is I'm going to try to keep the 100th episode to an hour as much as possible, as much as it really is a way for me to give back to everyone, as is this episode. I'm trying to have all the episodes leading up to the 100th one be special in some way. And as much as I want it to be special, and I mean, it could be 4 hours long and that could be an extra special gift for all of you. If it's 4 hours long, it really, I don't know if it would ever see the light of day in all honesty. So I need to keep it within that 1 hour time frame for me to really be able to make sure that it does all that it should and that I do justice with it so that it's worth your time to listen to, because I don't want to just give you a piece of crap to hear and be like, here's a 100th episode. Sorry that it's awful, but you got it anyway. Like, I really want it to be worth your time because I think it's really generous of everyone who listens to take the time out of all of your busy lives to listen to me talk. As I've said, probably, maybe not explicitly, but in a bunch of the questions that you've been asking me, Aaron, in my answers to them, I think I've been trying to stress that I'm not an expert. I'm just like everyone else. I'm not anyone special. I don't have any magic formula or magic information. I am really just a guy who lives in Massachusetts who talks into a microphone and for whatever reason that resonates with people. And I appreciate that you give me the time to listen to me. So I want to make it worthwhile. I don't want to just give you something to be like, here you go. I don't want to take you for granted. So I want to make sure that it's good. And unfortunately, that means long episodes are an hour long, and that's really what it is.
Well, I think you do a fine job, Jonathan, and I certainly seem to enjoy listening to you because I started listening with episode 84. I've listened to, you know, every episode. It's not a lot, but every episode since then I've listened to not every – I'm not as I'm just not as good with your – with catching your other show as close to release as possible. But I have gone back with Wargaming Recon back even to the CWF days, and I've listened to almost every back episode.
Don't.
So so I certainly enjoy it, and I don't think I'm the only one. So I think that counts for a lot, that you can't make everybody happy all the time, but some of us enjoy your show. Well, some of us definitely enjoy hearing you talk, so
Aaron, I really
keep on doing what you're doing. I'm sure you're going to do a good job with the 100th episode.
Thank you. I really appreciate the encouragement and the feedback and the fact that you enjoy what I've been doing. I have to say that I need to thank you for making my first guest appearance here a very special one. I've enjoyed being here as you hosted this episode and as you interviewed me and brought up all sorts of different stuff and gave me a chance to talk about things that I normally would never talk about here on Wargaming Recon. I hope that for all of the other listeners that this is something that you liked, and I know it's kind of out of the blue and not in the normal comfort zone. It's not normally something that's in the wheelhouse, but hopefully it's not too different for you, and maybe you like being able to peek behind the curtain, as it were, and have me in the hot seat as a change instead of having some of you guys in the hot seat. So I'm really appreciative and very thankful for you giving me this opportunity and for you agreeing to come on and do such a fantastic job as host for this episode.
Well, thank you for inviting me, Jonathan. I really enjoyed it. Like I had suggested in an email to you earlier, I was really looking forward to Henry Hyde turning the tables on you and asking you questions that would get you rolling the same way you got him to talk in that first big interview you did with him. That follow-up interview you did with him, you got him to talk a lot too, but I'm glad I'm, you know, he's a busy guy, and he's got a lot to say, so I'm glad I can kind of, take on this role. I thank you for inviting me and having a little bit of faith in me to do an adequate job.
Well, you did more than an adequate job. You did a fantastic job. I would also be remiss if I didn't tell all the listeners that they need to head on over to the show notes for this episode, because you have some amazing questions, and maybe with us conversing, they weren't able to write them down as quickly or to hear everything. So all of the questions that you will be sending to me, I'll put in the show notes. So you can get there by going to wargamingforums.com/WR93. That's wargamingforums.com/WR93. And there'll be links to stuff, all the usual stuff, but there'll be the questions and everything. And people can, of course, leave comments and email me and everything. I'd love to get feedback about this episode because it's so different from anything that we've ever done before. And that's part of the reason why we did it. And I think part of the charm of it, I can assure you that as we keep on progressing towards the big 100th episode, things are just going to keep on getting better and more interesting. I'm really, really trying to make every episode leading up to it something unique in some way, even more so than the usual episodes, to try to hype you up and get everyone extra excited about that 100th episode and to make like the 100th episode a party where I'm giving back to all of you. So I can't say enough how much I appreciate, Aaron, that you took the time out of your schedule to do this, because you get up extra early in the morning. People may not realize that, but you wake up like at the crack of dawn, as far as I'm concerned, to go to your job. And we're recording like at night during the week, which means that like you should be in bed by now is really where you should be. But instead, you're talking to me and letting me just rant for however long we've been recording. So that sacrifice means even more to me.
I enjoyed every minute of it, though.
I really am appreciative.
So awesome. I'm looking forward to the next couple shows you're going to do.
Yeah, definitely. It'll be a lot of fun. And I'm sure I'll be back here in the hot seat with you before too long. So thank you again for giving me this opportunity. And thank you, everyone, for listening to us talk. And of course, don't forget the show notes. And I can't ever end an episode without saying this, because it started as a whim just one day, me saying it. I was like, I should have a catchphrase because superheroes have something unique about them and I should be cool like a superhero. And so I started saying it, and then lo and behold, every episode I've done it. And if I haven't, someone's called me on it whenever I haven't. So I have to thank everyone again and just say, of course, don't forget, you gotta remember, keep on gaming.
Well, I'm glad you didn't make me say that part.
Oh, I thought of it and I was like, no, he did the intro. Yeah. And you realize this bit right here. Yeah, that's going
at that moment. I was like, oh no, is he going to actually ask me to say that?
No, you got off the hook this time, but maybe right, not on cool. Part two. I don't know.
This is Andreas, Apprentice of the White Order. I would like to invite you to listen to my letters, a humble collection of my observations of the various beautiful and very, very dangerous creatures that inhabit my world. I hope you enjoy it as part of the Monsters of the Shattered World on Troll in the Corner at trollitc.com.
Hey there, this is Ben Gerber from Troll in the Corner, and I'd like to invite you to listen to my podcast, Indie Talks. Indie Talks is a discussion about independent publishing, where we take a look at indie games, the people who write them, and the people who play them. We're going to branch a little farther afield as well and talk to some independent television and movie stars and creators, as well as crafters, all of who are related to gaming in some way, shape, or form. So please join me on the Troll in the Corner Network at trollitc.com and give Indie Talks a listen.
Geeks Explicitly. New episodes coming at you every Thursday. Talking about geek life. If you don't listen to Geeks Explicitly, then only at trollitc.com.
Hi, this is Tristan.
And this is Ben.
And this is Growing Geeks, a podcast where we talk about parenting as geeks
and use our skills to raise the next generation of awesome people.
Started out as a ball of lightning, and we'll all end up as ammonium chlorine, and somewhere in between we'll rule the world. Yeah, somewhere in between we'll rule the world. And we're gonna go down slow, gonna go down where the flowers grow, down, down, down where a need of
Wargaming Recon is a proud member of the Troll in the Corner podcast network. Visit www.trollitc.com for more information. This recording is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share-Alike 3.0 license. Look for Wargaming Recon online at www.wargamingforums.com. We're also on Twitter, Facebook, and Stitcher Radio. You can learn more about this episode by reading the show notes on our blog. Many thanks to Andrew and Court for inspiring the show's name. Thank you for listening, and keep on gaming.
If you heard it and you do like it, good. If you don't like it, what I'm supposed to do.